Hello and welcome to Differential Discussions. I'm Melissa.
I'm Dave.
And today we're back. We're welcoming back Dave McGlasson, and he's going to tell us a very interesting story. So,
Crazy story.
Dave, if you want to share your killer nurse story with us, we're all interested in hearing.
Yeah, I like your lead in. Actually, the title of the topic that I wrote, and there's been a couple things that I have put out over the years. The primary thing is heparin in the news, the Jeanine Jones killer nurse story. Jeanine Jones was a LVN that worked in the PEDICU unit at what was then called University Hospital in San Antonio, Texas. And when we talk about strange personalities, hers was so strange that Stephen King, the well-known horror author, used her as the template in the movie Misery as the nurse that would torture the patients. He got the idea from reading about her. There have been books written about it. There have been TV movies. The book was called The Death Shift because everybody that died was on the 3 to 11 shift. And which I also happened to be the supervisor. Again, I repeated this, I talked about this earlier. I was running the hemostasis immunology lab at the med school, the first laboratory that set up and tested for AIDS in Texas. I was also the evening supervisor on the 3 to 11 shift at the hospital. And unfortunately, all these children were dying on the 3 to 11 shift. So let's kind of set it up a little bit, so we can get started in a good manner. In the early 80s, I was working at the University of Texas Health Science Center and the University Hospital in San Antonio, Texas. I was working in the hemostasis immunology labs at the medical school and also working in the laboratory at the teaching hospital as the evening supervisor. On the evening shift, I was confronted by an angry, nervous intern, and I said, "So what's the problem, sir?" And he goes, "You guys' lab tests are all screwed." And I go, "Really? What's the matter?" And he said, "Your coag tests aren't right." I go, "Well, let me see what you got there." And he had results of a PT and a PTT. PT was greater than 60 seconds. The PTT was greater than 120 seconds. And when I looked at the data, I figured there's heparin involved here. And he said that was impossible. He said he drew the blood himself from a brachial stick, and the child was only 1 month old. And I said, "Okay." I said, "Let's see." So I turned to who just happened to be my best tech in hematology, a guy who's still working named Pete Gamboa. He's now the director of the laboratory at Audie Murphy Veterans Hospital, rather, in San Antonio. I said, "Pete, give me a reptilase time and a thrombin time." Now, the reptilase time is completely impervious to the effects of heparin. The thrombin time is exquisitely sensitive to it. So we ran those tests. Reptilase time came back normal. Thrombin time, I don't think it ever did clot. And so I said, "That's heparin." He said, "It's impossible." I said, "Is the child bleeding?" He goes, "Yeah, that's why I'm here." And I said, "Well, you might get up there and give him some protamine." I said, "I'm not telling you what to do, but I said, this is heparin. It can't be anything else." I said, "Here's the package insert." I showed that to him, and he was, "I don't understand." So he went up and performed some heroic measures, and the child lived. Now, we at the time, we had some issues earlier in the hospital where patients were coming down with heparin-induced thrombocytopenia and unexplained bleeds. And we traced that back to a young intern who had an attending that was really a kind of a bad guy. And what he was doing, he was flushing IV lines with 10,000 unit per ml instead of taking it down to like 50 and flushing them with it. And so we labeled that. And we thought it was something like that. You don't think medical people are intentionally going to hurt someone. They're out to do that. Well, after this incident happened with this child, the next day, I'm working in my lab at the med school, And all of a sudden, a young one of our young pathology residents, Dr. Northcutt, showed up with a security officer accompanying him. And I'm going, Northcutt get busted for something? They find him with weed or what? I don't know. You know, and I said, can I help you guys? And they said, yeah. And Dr. Northcutt had some samples that were on dry ice. And he said, we need to establish a chain of custody on this. And you need to store this where it will be secure. And I said, what's going on? And he said, your boss, Dr. Montiel, will be over to talk to you in a little bit. Well, I did what they said. We had a locked area where we could confine the samples, and I had to sign for them and everything. And I was getting a little bit confused at the time and concerned. Dr. Montiel came over and said, you know the problems that we've had with heparin in the past here, right? Yeah. And we solved that. And she said, yeah. She said, can you give us a definite quantity on what is in those plasma samples from last night and again today? And I said, well, I said, you know, of course, we were at the time, there was no anti-10A test. There was a test using protamine sulfate titrations, but I had never done it. And there's nobody else in town that had quantified it. And so I said, but I know where I can find it, and I can validate it in a couple of days. And so I worked on that. To give you an example of what this child had, you know, the normal therapeutic range for unfractionated heparin, low molecular weight heparins were not out then, but is 0.3 to 0.7 international units per ml. That's what you shoot for. This kid had a 14.1. Now, that's enough to anticoagulate a 250-pound man for a couple of days, where you wouldn't have to give him any more. And this was confirmed. When I did the test, I got the 14.1. They confirmed it, sending it to a laboratory who I knew of, but I didn't know the people that ran it. I later became very good friends of them, Colorado Coag, who is now, I think, called Esoterics out in Colorado. And they got the same thing I did. And we later learned on this that we possibly had a killer nurse on our hands in the PDICU. Her name was Janine Jones. And what was really bad was that the hospital seemed to want to cover it up, and the nursing supervisors didn't want anything blowing back on them. The hospital director at the time had visions of being a surgeon general. He was a retired military hospital officer. And it just, you know, was the nurses were getting upset because they're saying, we take care of these kids on the day and keep them alive, and then they die on this 3-to-11 shift. What's going on? And there were all kinds of things that were happening. Things were starting to disappear. Like I said, heparin was disappearing. And at the time, also, the labels weren't put on the vials like they were supposed to be. And stuff was missing from the vials, so they started having to treat it as a controlled substance. Excuse me, a mosquito just flew by me. If you Google serial killers, Janine Jones is up there with the big boys. She makes Ted Bundy look like a lightweight. You know, we were experiencing something that we never had never seen before. I wound up having to testify in front of the grand jury, and also at the criminal trial, and it was a very unnerving experience. In fact, the med school even hired a lawyer for me to get and practice with me on going through the testimony. In fact, I can admit this today. She sat out in the audience and she says, if you get into an area that you don't know, or that you know, they're questioning you on and you don't have a ready answer, don't answer it. And I will give you the heads up saying, yep, go ahead, or no. And then just default. And in the grand jury, I basically gave a class on what heparin does, how it affects antithrombin levels, through a coagulation curve up there. Most of the people had no clue what I was talking about, but you know, I dumbed it. I don't want to say dumbed it down, but I brought it down to a level that a layman could understand. And they asked me questions. They said, "Has anybody ever done this before?" And I said, "There have been overdoses, but I said, I can only imagine that they're accidental." I said, "Unless people like the Nazis tried to see, hey, how much of this can we give somebody before, you know?" But I said, "I don't even know heparin was used back then, but it was a whole different thing." I said, "I have never seen a case like, I've never heard of a case like this," and actually had done some research on it. I got involved with the case again about 4 years ago because she was coming up on parole. There were dumb laws back in Texas, and we still got some, gave you a 2-for-1 good behavior time where you could get out. And she was given 60 years for this case on this baby. She was later tried, and I'll get to that in a minute, after she left University Hospital. The way that their way of handling it and getting her out of the hospital was, oh, everybody in the PDICU now has to be an RN. She was only an LVN. And so she went up to Kerrville, Texas, and she started using succinylcholine up there, which is they use that like if they're on a child, especially. They give them that so they can intubate them without the child fighting the tube and tearing up the esophagus. But it's also what it's actually in its original form, it's called curare, where they South American natives would dip their poison darts in it and, you know, use it in their blowguns to bring down prey. Janine was an interesting personality. She may have killed as many as 47 people, and it could be even as high as 62. She shouldn't have ever been working. When she came over to a university hospital, she had been fired from another hospital for patient abuse. It was really a terrible thing that happened, and that she wasn't checked out further. And she also, because there were people that were saying, this person needs to go, and everybody else was saying, oh no, we got to protect the hospital and we can't go into this, people's careers were ruined. There was a made-for-TV movie, if you ever remember the old series L.A. Law, Susan Rutan and Veronica Hamill played, Susan Rutan played Janine. Boy, she did a good job too. And Veronica Hamill paid Dr. Kathy Holland, who was the doctor that took her with her up to Kerrville, Texas, and had to answer for the succinylcholine stuff. So what I did in this, Pete Elkind, who wrote the book, The Death Shift, and I actually have had several conversations on this, because she was going to be tried again in Texas for... because she was going to get out of prison, and everybody hit the ceiling that was still left. The patient that I worked up, and actually I worked up four altogether where I found suspicious results. All of them were still alive, luckily, and their families were saying, no, she should not get out of jail. So I get this call from the DA's office. This was about 4 years ago. And they said, Mr. McGlasson, I go, yeah, this is such and such from the DA's office. I haven't done anything bad, have I? Like, what? They said, no, you're on the alive list. I go, what? The alive list. Yeah. Several of the people who were involved in this case are now dead. And you're still alive, and you're the supervisor. You were the supervisor on that 3-to-11 shift and did the original work, right? Right. And we found your grand jury testimony, and we'd like for you to come down. Okay. Now, an interesting thing about that, going down to the DA's office, you have to walk through metal detectors. This case that I'm talking about is the first case where they ever used metal detectors, because family members were threatening witnesses, saying, you know, you better testify right or you're going to get it. And I'm going, okay, this is getting really hairy here. Other things that happened to me were the defense team tried to use a lady who I had graduated from college with to get grand jury testimony out of me. Well, when that happened, I had to call the DA's office and I had to call the lawyers at the hospital. And I said, hey, this is happening. What do I do? And they said, don't answer the phone. I said, well, I'm on call. Have your wife answer the phone. Okay, you know, so, you know, it gets more intense. When she was up for parole, I went down and I looked at the data again, and all of my stuff checked out. Now, let's talk about critical values here. I had to go through every piece of lab work that showed a critical value that was connected with that unit. And I found things that the legal team missed, but the guys in the lab did a great job. As you know, when you get a critical value, you need to repeat the test. Then if the test is out of the range of the assay, you got to dilute it and run it again. And then you got to calculate it out. Then you got to have somebody check your calculations. Then you phone the unit, and then you get the name of the person you called, the time, and all that. Well, there was one case where a child had been given Dilantin, and he went from, like, say, a 5.0 level, and 3 hours later, he was 48.1, and not doing well. Also, he had 118 glucose, which nobody paid any attention to at the time. At the same time, when that second sample came out, it was 598. She had jacked him up with Dilantin and the glucose, and they had missed that. And I found a couple other things that they had missed. And so I was going to have to testify again. She took a plea deal. And she'd already been sentenced for life, get this, up in Kerrville for the succinylcholine. She got 60 years for criminal abuse of a child for the one case that I testified in San Antonio. Now, again, she was, I mean, it was, let me just give you a quick example. Her first job at Southwest Methodist Hospital, she was fired after 8 months for patient abuse. Her second job at Community Hospital, which has another name now, was asked to leave after getting so many elective surgeries and with no sick leave or vacation accrued. They suspected that she had Munchausen syndrome by proxy. She wanted attention. If something was happening, it wasn't happening, she'd make it happen. She wanted the toughest kids, you know, the kids that were the sickest. She wanted to take care of them, stuff like that. She would constantly criticize other people. Her third position was at the Bexar County Hospital and the 3-11 ICU, and that was called the death shift by that time. She had skills. She could start an IV on a rock. She could find a vein in it. She was very, very good at it. And I personally knew her. Her supervisor loved her, but she was noted that she had 8 clinic critical errors in her first year, wrong dosing. Where was the heparin at that you supposedly used or didn't use? She only received informal counseling, no formal reprimands. The supervisor protected her. She showed up drunk on one shift and was messing with IV equipment. She was ordered to leave by the house staff. I mean, it was just on and on and on. One doctor, Dr. Debbie Rash, who I was extremely familiar with, she was the one that took care of my son who was in that PDICU a year later, found her giving a patient calcium for no reason. Dr. Jim Robotham, who was one of the new types of intensivists and full-time specialists, graduate of Johns Hopkins, top of his class, wanted to make the place a world-class thing, and he thought Janine was dedicated, and she buried him. She got him in trouble. Another child that I worked up was left with the bed down, and the child rolled out with IVs attached. Janine had not put the bedpost up. And so this high incidence of kids dying and everything, they finally did take some action. Now, the issue with the heparin was just the start of it. Pete Elkind, who wrote the book, The Death Shift, said, you know, he said, you just happened to be right in the middle of the eye of the storm when you found the heparin. That's when they really started taking a look at her. Now, if you've ever been, never been involved in a forensic case, you don't want to be. As I found out, it was very nerve-wracking. And seriously, I was constantly bombarded for about 3 years from the time that she left and went to Kerrville till they got her into trial and everything. And I was constantly having to go back and testify and show my data and everything. And I finally got back my original lab notes from it about a year ago. And it was really, and in fact, I said, you know what? I don't want to keep these. I just went out and burned them. I said, they've got patient information on them. I'm just going to go ahead and get rid of them. But the DA had had them the whole time. Now, heparin can be, this case was an extreme case of a damaged person causing problems with kids. Like I said, heparin at that time was what she used. And a lot of things can, you know, happen with that. Now, there is another case about accidental heparin overdoses. If you've ever heard of the actor Dennis Quaid, great actor. He's got a brother named Randy Quaid, who is also an actor. He had a set of twins that received an accidental overdose of heparin at Cedars of Sinai, heavyweight hospital, big time stuff, right? His babies in 2007 were given 1,000 times the intended doses of heparin while being treated at that center. At 11:30 hours and at 17:30 hours on the day that they were treated, twins were dosed with a concentration of 10,000 units per ml of unfractionated heparin. The dose was supposed to be 10. A third child was also admitted and given the wrong dose of the medication, which is used as a flush for heparin locks, catheters, intravenous lines, things like that. All three children survived the overdoses without any long-term health issues. Now, the hospital listed three separate safety mistakes they made. Pharmacy tech took the heparin from the pharmacy supply without having a second technician validate the concentration. That's what they're supposed to do. Now, remember, this is 2007, 26 years later than what we dealt with. Then the heparin was delivered to a satellite pharmacy location that's responsible for the medications for the PDICU. And the third pharmacy technician did not verify the concentration. Therefore, three pharmacy personnel didn't follow protocol. The nursing personnel who gave the unfractionated heparin to the three subjects did not verify the drug was the correct concentration of medication before administering the drug. The three staffers were relieved of duty after investigation, according to Cedars of Sinai. Now, because of this particular case and other many other measures taken place to prevent these incidents from occurring, beginning in the early 2000s, there were reports of heparin overdoses resulting in patients, you know, experiencing harm. In fact, heparin is one of the most dangerous drugs that you can give to somebody. And the overdoses are, I think that year between 2001 and 2006, there was something like 16,000 heparin overdoses that were blamed on incorrect dosing. This was a Los Angeles Times investigation when they were researching the Quaid twins incident. And the most notable of these were those three kids. They brought to... these events brought to the issues to light and how special care and restrictions should be in place for anticoagulation agents, all of them. In response to safety concerns, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration and the FDA released a safety announcement in late 2012 regarding heparin, healthcare professionals, caregivers, and providers about container label changes. And they did make them, but not every company standardized the color coding on these things. And I don't, you know, I just in the past couple of days, I've called three hospitals and talked to the lead pharmacy people. And I said, are all of these companies now using like, is 10,000 units green, is, you know, and so on? And they said, unfortunately, no. That's why we try to stick with the same ones. And when we put out our information on it, it should be label green, such and such, 10,000 unit per ml. You know how in the lab they always tell us check something three times? Well, they had to tell pharmacy techs the same thing. Isn't that interesting?
It's actually curious to me because, like, having a color-coded system literally, in my mind, loses all utility and becomes a hazard when you have different manufacturers using different colors and it's not standardized.
Absolutely.
That seems foolish in my mind. But
yeah. Well, in the lawsuit the Quades filed, they contended that Baxter Healthcare, who had the made the drug, knew that the other patients had died as a result of similar errors involving heparin and using similar background covers on the labels for both the low and the high concentration. Like you couldn't tell the difference between a putty colored and a white colored, you know, that type of thing. You know, why they didn't read the concentration again, you know, I don't know, but you know how they always taught us, okay, pick up the reagent, look at it before you use it, and then before you administer it, that type of thing. So as you can see, heparin can be a very dangerous drug. I saw it in a criminal case. Case that they talked about in the that I referred to actually in the Los Angeles Times with the Quade twins. Interestingly enough, Pete Elkind, who wrote that book, The Death Shift, said, you know what? The guy that you cited in the paper that you wrote was my partner on the Los Angeles Times for 10 years. I thought, interesting how all this goes together. Janine, though, like I said, was an extremely interesting personality. She did have skills. I remember one night when I was on call, we used to have our toxicology techs on call because the type of testing that we used at the time was an electrophoresis type method. We didn't have the type of stuff that we have today, of course. And we had them on call. We had some kids that were coming in. They got into mommy's hypnotics. We didn't know exactly what they had. I called the ICU and said, when these kids get in, I need gastric, blood, and urine. And I said, I've got my tech standing by. We're ready to roll. Didn't hear anything for 30 minutes after the kids got there. So I went up on the floor and I said, hey, I need these samples. And Janine comes up just all wired. She says, Dave, what do you need? What do you need? I told her I had everything in 10 minutes. Total. I mean, when something was happening, man, she was into it, you know, but she was just one of those type of personalities. Like if you said you drank a six pack, she had a fifth of Jack, you know, I mean, that kind of person. Could cuss like worse than a sailor. It was just an extreme personality. And it was very interesting when they brought her back for trial for the second time when they were going to indict her. And she comes back, she's on a walker. And my wife but I both said, she's faking that. Yeah, she's been in prison all this time, but she's faking that. What I can't believe is she survived in prison all this time. Usually they don't take kindly to child killers. But the issue was that I was very familiar with the testing that we had at the time. I was in the right place at the right time, and I had the right techs to do the job. The guys that did the dilantin and the chemistry testing on this, they said, well, were these people competent? I said, well, I would assume so. One of them is a pathologist now, and the other one is an oral surgeon. Yeah, they were lab techs at the time. They kind of went on and, upgraded their careers a little bit more. With that, any questions from you people?
Just think it's an extraordinary story, and it's sort of sad, right? Because I would think most people get into healthcare to make a positive impact, but we have to guard against those who would be the wolf in sheep's
Right.
clothing. It's just extraordinary, and just to see, I think now there's much more. I'm not a, not a working professional nurse, or but now I feel like there's a much tighter control on medications and like the custody of the medications, right?
Yeah.
I think it's interesting you bring up how dangerous heparin is, and I don't know this for a fact, but geez, it's probably one of the most widely used
Absolutely.
medications out there in a hospital setting, right? Yeah, no, it's an extraordinary story, and I empathize with you that so many people are witnesses in one way or another. You had a very professional kind of credential to go along with your witness testimony, but so many folks are witnesses to horrible things, and it is incredibly stressful, and all the different outside pressures that get put on witnesses.
Oh.
I just want to say thank you for doing the right thing
Dave, let me tell you
because,
one quick story.
sure.
One of the doctors who caught her giving a patient glucose without getting a glucose level beforehand, her name was Dr. Cheryl Cipriani. We both got our subpoenas the same day. And we were talking in the hallway about this, and a lady went by on that was pushing a linen cart. And having to hear us talking, she comes over and says, "Are you guys talking about those baby deaths? My boy Jimmy was the one of the people that she tried to kill up in Curva. You better testify right." We're going, okay, like, God, is there no place safe here?
And those are victims who have the
Yes.
right intent, like, so geez, it's def that's really tricky because there's
Yeah.
so much pain there, right?
Absolutely. One of the pharmacy heads told me yesterday, she said, "Here's how heparin is treated now. It is not a controlled substance, but it's listed as a dangerous substance. So it's like right below it. And we do keep track of it, but it's not, in the class of heroin or something like or any of the opioids, something like that." Like I said, there is a really good forensic files on her. That you can look up that goes a lot more into the criminal details on this. But yeah, it's one that I never want to see again.
I'm sure.
And how it keeps. I told my wife, I said, I thought I was behind all this when they called me, and she said, "Hey, just do what you did before." She said, "I don't think there's anybody left who's going to be coming after you." I said, "I don't know. I hope not. I said, I'm just glad that she is. I'm scared that she's out of a prison right now, even though she's in a county prison, and they're gonna I'll be happy when they send her back."
Well,
You got anything, Melissa?
I think the only other thing that I want to highlight is a lot of our audience is educators and students. And I think students think sometimes that, well, I'm just going to end up in the lab doing testing and I'm not going to, make a big difference. I'll make a difference, in the lab. But we can have a huge impact as laboratorians working in the lab. I mean,
You aren't
look,
just
this
pushing a, you aren't
exactly
just
this.
pushing a button and turning out a result. There's what I always tell people, like I used to, people that would get freaked out and really excited about something coming into the ER that was very unusual, like a new leukemia or a bleeding disorder or something like that. And I said, "Hey, wait a minute. What you should be thinking about is, what can I do to help that person who's on the other end of this sample?" And I said, "You're going to make a big difference in their life because theirs has changed dramatically today. And you're the first person to, give them that number to help the treatment on them."
So
Yeah.
true. I think we do kind of get lost in the routine samples a little, but it are those moments where we can rise to the occasion and provide real important data that, like you say, this person's life changed today, right? That is a yeah.
And the case that you shared with us is just a really extreme, large, terrifying example of the impact and the quality of care that we can provide in the laboratory to our patients and help save lives from people like that, which you don't expect in healthcare, like you were saying earlier. But you know, if we do find that, again, that's part of our job is to help prevent that kind of stuff if we can, you know, that kind of thing. So I think it's a really good example of the impact that we can have. It's an extreme example that we're not all going to go through, thankfully, but you know, it is a big example of the impact we can have as laboratorians. So thank you for sharing that with us.
Oh, I'm glad to. There's a few other things on my blog, Clock Club, that some people might be interested in, like how cannabinoids affect your coagulation system. It ain't the little Mother Nature that we thought it was 30 years ago. It has some severe effects on you. So that might be one. I remember when I put that out, that one of the people from Diapharma had to laugh, said, "Some of the old stoners are better rethinking their lives now after they're reading this." So there's a few on there like that. So anytime, get in touch. I'll be glad to answer the questions. And like I said, if I don't know it, I know people that do. So thanks a lot, guys. I really enjoyed today's conversations, and invite me back anytime.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Thank
Thanks
you
so
for
much, Dave.
joining us. We will link the Diapharma website in the description. So if you want more information, you can click right on that link and it'll bring you right to the Clock Club blog that Dave was telling us about. So, Dave, thank you for joining us, and everybody else, thanks for listening.
Thanks for your time.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.